All right, so I'm going to carry on talking about hardware for a few minutes, about Kekkerai, which is the successor to Bicep 2 that John just talked about. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about Bicep 2 data analysis, which will probably be the most interesting part for many of you. So the rationale behind Kekkerai was simply to maximally exploit infrastructure and technology, infrastructure that existed because of the DAISY experiment. So there's this great big telescope mount and a nice ground shield on a tower attached to a nice building, this Maypole building at the South Pole. And also to maximally exploit the technology that had been developed for Bicep 2. So John showed you the focal plane, and the idea is that it's mass replicatable. So we thought, let's replicate it some more. So we also switched in this process from liquid helium cooling to pulse tube coolers, which was use a lot of electric power, but it was a huge, I mean, there was no way that the station was going to support 5 liquid cooled receivers, right? So that was a huge, just a kind of logistical, technological shift.
Were they uninitiated? How did they
work? They send pulses of compressed helium down a tube and magically heat migrates in the other direction. And more than that, I'm not really sure. It's basically like the piston out of a mechanical cooler, piston-based cooler, is replaced by a kind of slug of compressed helium gas oscillating in a tube.
Where
are they developed? I don't know. A few decades ago, I think. And now you can buy them as a commercial product. ADK gets you a system, and it delivers, 50 watts of cooling power at 50 Kelvin? What is it? Maybe it's 20 watts at 50 Kelvin, and how much? A few watts at 4 Kelvin? Yeah. It depends on how hard you work it, but anyway, they're awesome. No more liquid helium.
The cooling effect was discovered accidentally.
All right, so the segmentation of the hardware responsibilities are shown here. The different institutions took on different parts of the project. It's a big lot of work to make 5 of these things, so we have to segment it. This is the collaboration about a little over a year ago, so showing the kind of scale that our collaboration's grown to. This is just kind of the core team. There are many other people that are not shown here. These are mostly people that are working full-time on the project, Bicep 2 or Keck. So here's a computer rendering of the 5 receivers packed into the drum. This is now real. You'll see a picture of it in a moment. This is a cross-section of the receiver, much more compact than the Bicep 2 receiver because there's no need for the big liquid helium, liquid nitrogen tanks, liquid helium tanks. Here's the pulse tube cooler on the side and a kind of addendum to the cryostat. So basically, it's 5 copies of Bicep 2 on the old platform built for DAISY. That's the bottom line message. 2,500 TES detectors. And in the first season, we only had 3, but in 2012 and 2013, we have 5 receivers going forward. So, just the production line, you know, crank the cryostats out, mass production, crank the focal planes out, the receiver inserts, and then putting it all together. Some of them were tested in the high bay, to map beams. And so we had this kind of production line of each institution taking on one part of the process.
Of interactivity with here. Maybe you have directly on the board.
What?
So this is chronological cosmology. Ah, you're welcome to stay, of course, but this is not the journalist talk that you might be expecting.
The journalist talk is canceled.
Yes, which is canceled.
All right, so we had this kind of production line thing going on, and then it all equipment ended up at Pol, and we have had a big team at Pol working on this, especially in the first season, first and second seasons, pushing to get all the receivers working by station close, because we have, as you know, only this kind of 3-month period where everything has to come together and be made to work at Pol. Then we have to leave. And here's the team a year and a half ago at the end of the season when we got all 5 on for the first time. And it was really quite a squeeze to get them in, right? They only just fit. So it was a pretty complicated activity. And then this is Keck at sunset. So this is the South Pole Station over here. The Earth's rotational axis is about here, about a kilometer away. And here's a really nice photograph taken from the calibration mast. So this guy's our winner, Robert Schwartz, and he put his camera up on the top of the mast, cranked it up there, and set it on time delay, or had a remote control or something. So this is him getting ready for the long Antarctic night. The sun is setting. You can see these very long shadows. And the telescope getting ready to observe.
Is it like yellow from the sunlight?
So the sun's over here, right? You can see these long shadows. Yeah, so this is plywood. This is plywood. Yeah, and it's aluminum on the inside and plywood on the outside.
Make it out of coal?
I wish. Those days are over. So I just want to emphasize that Keck also has a far-field flat mirror, about exactly the same idea as the one that John showed you for BICEP 2, only it's vastly larger. So on these huge carbon fiber rods, this is kind of 10 feet across aluminum honeycomb panel, hoisted up above this great big ground shield. So the beams, the calibration sources on the building over here, shoots the beam off the 45-degree mirror down into the receivers. So we can do all of the same beam mapping operations that we are used to doing. So there are several different kinds. This one, I think, is the non-thermal source, but there are various sizes of thermal source. They've grown bigger and bigger. They rejoice in names like Z-Chopper and Uber-Chopper, which is even bigger than Z-Chopper. It's like a propeller blade off an airplane behind it. So yeah, various different kinds of sources, rotating and non-rotating, thermal and non-thermal. So this is just a histogram, a stacked histogram of the per detector NETs, so the number per 20 Kelvin wide bin. And you can see there's a vast number of detectors in these five different receivers. You can also see, if you look carefully at this plot, that two of the receivers are better. RXs 3 and 4 are better in the 2012-2013 season. And so there's room for improvement. They could all be that good, right, presumably. The array NET is now 9.5 microkelvin root seconds. So possibly the most sensitive receiver yet to operate. Okay, so now I'm going to run through. So that's enough of Keck, right? So Keck is operating. It's taking data. It's going to take data for several more years. And there's scope to make it even better. But now I'm going to step back and just talk about the analysis of data from BICEP 2. So we're kind of backed up, right? We have this new experiment, Keck, running, but we are still analyzing the data from BICEP 2. There's a lot of it. We took data on BICEP 2, 2010, 2011, 2012, finished observing last fall. So there's a total of about 17,000 scan sets, hours of data effectively, that go into this analysis. It's about 18 terabytes of raw data. It's getting a little unwieldy. And then when we start processing it, it grows enormously, so it's kind of a pain. We've implemented a sophisticated automatic cut framework. So this is so much data, so many channels, and so much time, you can't afford to be picking through it manually. So we've built a very automated system for finding the data that we want to actually use, which can cope with the weather variations. I'll show you those in a moment. And it can cope with the extremely fussy squid-based readout system that we now have in order to do the multiplexing. The squids are a pain. I wish we could get rid of them. So here is a low-level redux plot. So one of these is made for every 17,000 scan sets. And what you're seeing in the top line here is that this is time, about 50 minutes across the main panel here. This is the telescope scanning backwards and forwards in azimuth angle. This is the time order data corresponding to that for the pair sum and the pair difference, with all of the 1,200 pairs stacked on top of each other, right? So it's a plot that'll only show you crazy events, really. You can get the point of these plots is that when we apply the first round and second round cuts, you want to be sure that there's no craziness left in these plots, right? So when you... They are arbitrary. The x-axis, this is hours, and the y-axis is just arbitrary, ADC units.
What do you call scan
So this is 50 scans backwards and forwards. It takes about 50 minutes. And we just call that a scan set, right? The telescope scans backwards and forwards over a fixed range of azimuth for 50 minutes, right? So the sky is drifting by, right? So we can subtract out a scan synchronous component if we wish. I'll come to that in a moment. And you still leave in the CMB. You filter the CMB because the sky's only drifting by 15 degrees. But so this is an observation strategy which is designed such that you can take out any ground fixed component. At the beginning and the end of each scan set, we do an L-nod, where the telescope moves. This is elevation angle here. You can see it goes up and then down. And that injects a ramp into the bolometer time streams. We then use the scale factor of each of these ramps to scale, to apply relative gain calibrations to each of the channels and before we pair sum and pair difference. And so in the pair difference, you'd see no response to the L-nod because it's common mode, right? The atmosphere is unpolarized. And so that is a common mode signal that differences out perfectly once you've applied the right relative gain. Okay, I think that's...
rough sky signal you're seeing, are you getting about 10 Kelvin on the sky?
This is we're only seeing the modulation of the sky, right? Because we're scanning backwards and forwards across it. And this is very variable, how much structure you see in this. So this is goodish weather. It's not like a super cherry-picked day. But you can see there's a little more structure in the pair sum than in the pair difference. So we're seeing the atmosphere above the noise. If you switch to a day where the weather is not so good, you start to see structure, right? But it's structure that evolves in time. So think about it as if there are lumpy clouds drifting through the telescope's line of sight as it's scanning backwards and forwards. So a big lump comes in, and you start to see a large scan synchronous signal, and then it drifts out, and you start to see a smaller, things quieten down again.
So what angle are you at relative?
About 50 degrees from the horizon. And we're scanning back like this. So what the fluctuations are, it's massively variable, right? I don't care what the DC level is. No. So the DC level, I mean, there's a mixed component and an unmixed component, right? And what you see in the structure is the unmixed component. It's lumps of water vapor. It's clouds, right? And so that's the thing that's producing the modulation. Okay, so exactly what we do with this data. So this is just a mean on a per half scan. So we call each scan out and or back a half scan, right? And here, P0 filter, just the mean has been taken out of each one. So otherwise, this would wander off scale, right? I mean, you know, the atmosphere is wandering about. So, I thought somebody might ask that question. So cuts have been applied in here, right? So I think that there are some pair differences here that are hovering right on the edge of being cut. And then when you go to the bad weather, actually they got worse, and so they've been cut out, right? They've been trimmed out. So I think that's just a kind of visual illusion. These plots are useful for some things and not very useful for other things, because there's 1,200 pairs in here, right? So you can't see most of them. You tend to, what your eyes see is dominated by the worst few. So the cuts are automatic, and as the weather gets worse, more data will get cut, right? Because things will go above thresholds that are sitting right on the edge of.
Yeah, are those cuts somewhat arbitrary? Because you're saying that basically you can difference. You know, would you be fine if you didn't make any cuts at all, except for really pathological factors?
So the cuts are always a soft business, right? So we've constructed this complicated, sophisticated cut framework, and we can tune the parameters around and see if the final results care much. So we defer as many of the cuts to as late in the analysis as possible so that we can tune them. Exactly what cut has caused those channels to disappear, I don't know. Right? I'd have to go and look it up. So we try not to cut on the data itself in as much as possible. Many of the cuts are done on the L-nods and the matching before and after, and the pair ratios, particularly the matching of the pair ratio before and after. So I'll show you that. I think that's the next plot, right. So now, this is a year of data.
One quick question before. Atmosphere clearly, largely, is polarized. So what's the residual polarization in the kind of time frame?
Well, the atmosphere is extremely unpolarized, and I think for the purposes of everything that I'm going to show here, it is unpolarized. Right? Is there any?
Including at the level of trying to do limits.
That's not the issue of the atmosphere being polarized. It's the question of how it feeds into the systematics of the atmosphere. You have second order effects where you have gain variations, you have blobs, and right through that. I think that's the question.
Well, I get that question, but largely unpolarized.
Well, I say largely unpolarized because you can only prove that it's unpolarized to some level using raw data like this, right? And so I don't really want to talk too much about the polarization or not of the atmosphere. For the purposes of everything I'm going to show, it's unpolarized as far as we can tell, right?
So is Keck giving the best limits on atmospheric polarization that exists?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we do everything we can to avoid looking for the polarization of the atmosphere, right? I don't really want to get into it. John's frowning at me because what I'm saying is skirting around the truth, perhaps. But we could spend 3 hours talking about it, and it would be irrelevant to the CMB problem that we're trying to solve. Right? I'm not. I want to look through it. Anyway, look, here's a parameter that we cut on, right? So this, you can't read it, but this is L0 ABBA. So this is the ratio of the pair gain of a given of each pair. So the color map is now pairs, all pairs top to bottom. So it's the ratio of the pair gain, the ratio of ratios before and after, right? Because we do an L0 before and an L0 after. So this is something that you'd like it to be pretty stable, right? You want the rel gain. If you get it wrong, you're leaking temperature to polarization, and so you want it to be accurate and you want it to be stable. But here we're only setting a threshold of 10%, right? So it's allowed to vary by 10%, and this is the kind of cut mask that results from that. So we set a relatively weak cut on this, and so I was interested that Planck was worrying about much smaller variations in the pair gain ratios. Now, we can inject fluctuations on the order of 10% into the analysis, or fluctuations like the ones that we appear to see into the analysis, on the assumption that it's real and not. But it's noise, like fluctuations, right? So sometimes it's... Well, I think it's the averaging down, is what I'm trying to get at here. So we have 17,000 scan sets, right? They're all fluctuating up and down. We have 1,200 pairs. They're all fluctuating up and down. So long as they fluctuate symmetrically, sometimes you're leaking T into plus Q, sometimes T into minus Q, and it averages out, right? And we can do simulations where we inject these fluctuations, and they make no difference to the final result. So it may be just because we have more averaging down going on. That's the difference. I was a little unclear, but I'd like to talk to you later about that.
Do you know what the rejection is between the common mode and the differential mode?
Yeah. So, I mean, these numbers fluctuate at the percent level, right? They're not super accurate. When you do an L nod, you take a pair gain ratio, and then you do another L nod, and you take a pair gain ratio. There's fluctuation in there, right? You can see that in this plot. This is a few percent fluctuation here, and clearly it happens.
What right? In your situation, the plot situation, is that I can imagine that this thing is your variation are actually Gaussian distributed.
Yeah, they are.
The plot then you can see actually features.
Well, but it probably would be Gaussian distributed without enough time, right? It's just that there's not enough.
But then if you go to very little L, how many realizations are there?
Yeah, I think it's just an averaging down thing. We average down a hell of a lot more times, and so it goes out. All right, so that's cuts, right? So we do cuts on a bunch of different parameters. Many of them are just correlated with weather, so the uniqueness of any given cut is quite small. You tend to, as you devise more statistics, you find that they're all just cutting out the same data. And so now, this is 3 complete years of time, okay, on the x-axis. This is pair number. Oh, sorry, I was giving the wrong number. I was giving the Keck number of pairs. We've got about 200 pairs. And this, the blue areas have been NAND out, right? So this is data we don't use. So these are bad weather periods. Vertical bars are bad weather periods because it takes out all channels. And then you've got some channels that just, some pairs that aren't really there, so they're black lines across the whole plot. And then you have a little bit of ripple on top of that. So here is just being plotted the weight, right? So this is the white noise the inverse of the variance, the weight that we use when we add into the map. And so you can see that in 2010, things were much poorer, the weights were much lower than in 2011. And then in late 2011, we gained back a bunch of channels here, so 2012 was the best. And so these are the weights, the total weights of each scan set, stepping up as we made these various improvements to the system. Now, the switch from 2010 to 20, this switch in late 2010, actually, here, the biggest step, this was just retuning the biases, right? Yeah. So this is how tricky the readout system is, right? You can make the experiment dramatically more sensitive just by retuning, you know, numbers in the biasing system. The Nyquist was, that's this step here. That's bias changes, this is readout frequency change, and then this is just adding back in that one column. And so you can see the kind of high energy physics style cumulative weight plot here. All right, so basic analysis steps. So we do deconvolution and deglitching. We equalize the channel pair gains using LNODs. Then we pair difference, and we segment into half scans, and we apply some basic filtering to each half scan. Typically, we use third-order polyfiltering in the actual data analysis I'm going to show you. It's pretty arbitrary. This is just the kind of choice that was made sometime in the analysis development. We still do it. You could probably tune it down without making too much difference. We've been in azimuth to form scan synchronous a template and subtract. And again, that has a tiny effect on the final result. But it's something that we traditionally do, because John mentioned it was necessary to pass final checks in the BICEP 1 analysis. It's about 30 seconds. So we then accumulate into pair maps, which is basically just a bin scan set. And then we also accumulate these deprojection templates. So when we're scanning on the sky, they have the scan trajectory on the sky, and we sample off of a template of what the sky is supposed to look like, which used to come from WMAP and it now comes from PLOG. And so you sample off of that, and you bin that also identically to the way you're binning the real data. And so that gives you, the template is the temperature map is going to be the rel gain deprojection template, and then various derivative combinations of the temperature map give you these other deprojection modes corresponding to AB offset X, AB offset Y, so centroid offset X and Y, the modes that John was showing you, then the beam size difference and the ellipticity differences.
Sorry to be dumb, but as you're accumulating the maps, are they weighted?
Yeah, so there's all the weighting that's going into the maps is going into the templates as well, so that they're regressible one versus the other. Okay, so then we sum up over 10 elevation steps, so that each scan set is at one elevation, then you step to the next elevation and scan again. After 10 steps, we regress the templates, the deprojection templates against the real data, and we subtract out, right? So you could just regress them and just keep them as informational knowledge. But here we actually subtract them out of that step, and thereby you're allowing these deprojection modes to vary in amplitude over a 10 hours time scale. And so for the AB offset, for the differential pointing, that's kind of dumb actually, because we have very little evidence that it varies at all over 3 years of data, right? For the rel gains, it probably is not a crazy thing to do. There is some evidence for variation. The rel gains, so this is not noise from the LNODs. The reason you've got to do a rel gain deprojection now is that probably mostly dominated by differential passband. So we're calibrating off of the atmosphere, but then we're observing the CMB. So the rel gain that applies from the atmosphere, that comes from the atmosphere, does not necessarily apply to the CMB accurately, right? So these are small corrections, probably mostly dominated by differential passband. Yeah, about 10 hours of data. Yeah. Okay, so here is a Q map from 3 years of data, and here is the U map, and you can see they have these beautiful horizontal, vertical, and 45-degree patterns that correspond to an EMOD sky. So these are possibly the deepest maps made of these at these angular scales of the CMB to date. The RMS here is including the actual fluctuation of the CMB. So the noise level in here is about 0.12 microkelvin degree. and the area, effective area, is about 400 square degrees. So because of the way that the focal plane is laid out and because of the way it observes the sky, there's a very natural, very smooth apodization that's happening, right? So the maps are heavily tapered towards the edge. And so we just divide the map by the variance map, which is also constructed in this process, this mapping process. And then we Fourier transform that. So here are the Fourier transforms of Q and U, which have these funny, you know, vertical, horizontal cross and 45 degree cross patterns. You can see in here the first peak in the EMOD spectrum, the first dip and the second peak, right? Extremely high signal to noise. This trough down the y-axis is due to the scan-wise filtering that we've done, right? So the band powers are the average around these annuli, these kind of bullseye annuli that are shown here. And then that polyfiltering and ground subtraction trough is along the y-axis. And so you've down-weighted some of the modes, and the fraction of modes that you've down-weighted is getting smaller as you go to higher L numbers, because there's a smaller fraction in this kind of constant width region that's been down-weighted. So the impact of that is relatively modest, right? If you were to do sims where you don't do this down-weighting, the error bars are maybe 10 or 20% bigger in this L of 40 bin. So it's a smaller fact.
Did you say why the structure?
This is Fourier transforms of Q and U. Q and U have preferential directions on the sky, so you get preferential directions in the Fourier plane. So now you go from Q and U to E and B, so you make this simple rotation. I'm to apologize for the color scale shifting here. This is on a much wider color stretch. And so now this is in a CL sense, and in the 2D sense, the EMO power spectrum. So you can see the first bump, the first trough, the next bump. So extremely high signal-to-noise measurements of EMOD power. Okay, so how do we know that this is real? Okay, so first thing you can do is you can do a jackknife. So we make maps out of two subsets of data and difference those maps, and then Fourier transform that and convert it into EMODs. And so doing that, this is the first half, second half jack. A jackknife where we split the data into the first half of the running and the second half of the running, made completely independent maps of both and differenced them. And you can see that the cancellation of EMOD power is enormous in terms of signal to noise. Right? So this is holding the color scale stretch, it just goes black. Right? Perfectly cancels. All right, so then let's perform the DEC jackknife. So a DEC jackknife is a difference test. So we observe at four different DEC angles, so four different rotation angles of the instrument on the sky. And remember, the sky is not rotating at South Pole, it's just going round and round, right? So these are really just four discrete angles that we've observed the sky at. You only need two to form Q and U maps, separated by 45 degrees. Or something like that. And so we've got two pairs. We've got 0 and 45, and then we've got 180 and 225, effectively. And so we can make a map from 0 and 45 and a map from 180 and 225, and we can difference those. And when you do that, you get a very much different picture. You get a very poor cancellation. So remember, this is the sum map, right, the non-jackknife map, E-modes. That's the first half, second half jack, which works. And that's the DEC jack, which doesn't work at all, as you can see. Right? It works very poorly. You've got loads of residual signal in that DEC jackknife map. So why is that? So that is because our primary beam imperfection is this AB centroid offset, right? And an AB centroid offset is a leakage of gradient of T into polarization. Now, if you have a uniform offset across your focal plane, and then you rotate the focal plane 180, you flip that leakage from the gradient of T into Q the negative gradient of T into Q, right? So just rotating the instrument by 180 degrees cancels that out, right? So not all beam systematics are, some beam systematics can be canceled out just in the instrument, just in the observation strategy. And this one cancels out very, very heavily in that manner because our AB offset is largely common mode. So however, the DEC jackknife, where you make maps of the 0 and the 180 conjugates and difference them, that throws this effect into stark relief. Okay, so here in the non-jackknife, we're benefiting hugely from this AB offset cancellation due to the observation strategy. And here in the deck jackknife, we're throwing that into the darkest possible relief.
And it looks just a lot like a U already forgot which way to go.
No, this is, let's see. No, so the fact that it looks like the Q or the U is irrelevant. This is E-mods now. And so the reason it's got this lobe structure is now entirely different, actually. So it's now that's the preferential direction of the AB offsets on the sky that's producing the directionality in this map. Okay, so the deck jackknife does really badly, right? So deep projection can remove this. So deep projection, what we've done is we've accumulated the signal that you would get for an X offset and a Y offset from the WMAP template or the Planck template. And so we can deproject that signal out per group of 10 scan sets. And at the moment, we're doing it per group of 10 scan sets. You could do it over any time scale. And so when you do that, this very badly failing deck jackknife goes to this, a deck jackknife that looks very clean. All right, so this is a wonderful demonstration of a beam systematic causing a jackknife failure, which we can then fix by doing the deprojection. It wasn't enough. All right. So as John said, for bicep one, the only one that seemed relevant, so the effect was smaller. The AB offsets were smaller. They were less uniform. And they were not relevant versus the noise. So bicep two has the worst AB offsets. Yeah. Bicep two has the worst AB offsets of any experiment that we've built, right? Keck is better again, because as we mentioned, they've made the detectors better. OK, so at the moment, we allow the coefficients to vary with time. We don't need to for the diff point. For the rel gain, we probably do. The rel gain is a much smaller effect and much harder to show you know, so clearly in such plots.
The risk of being the same thing. So, I'll keep it brief. It looks like you are actually,
I should have finished already.
I can hold it back. It looks like you're actually correcting for the effect, right? So, since you're
okay,
since when you show the deck jackknife again, it passes now, right? So you've actually taken something out.
Yes, we are removing the contaminated modes, or the potentially contaminated, the contaminated modes, or potentially contaminated modes. We're just removing them from the map.
That's right? That's temperature.
Yeah, but the potentially contaminated modes in the E and B maps that we're removing, right? And we're just throwing them out in the same way that we do the scan-wise filtering. And that distorts the sky pattern, right? It's a loss. I mean, it gives you a map which is not the true map of the sky. It's the map of the sky with these modes filtered out.
So
it does the same thing.
You're subtracting those modes. In other words, yeah, I understand. You're in this case putting a filter that filters specifically for those modes. So you're
yes.
Storing that information away.
I mean, yeah.
The jackknife looks like it has almost as much signal as the signal, which I'm sure is just the color signal. It seems like you'd be losing a lot of stuff.
It's a small fraction of the total mods.
If you didn't rotate your deck, if you just sat in one orientation for the whole season, and you projected out those modes, would you then? In other words, are you really actually using the fact that if you average over deck, it goes away?
No, you're using the template. So the template is saying that it's telling you how the T enters the Q and the U, right? And so then you can remove that single, effectively single spatial mode, although we're doing it over a smaller time scale and fewer, less sky area. But you're removing quite a finite number of spatial mods from the Q and the U maps.
So you'd be okay with no deck rotation?
No, we have to have deck rotation, otherwise we can't measure. All our detectors are oriented the same way, right? So, I mean, we can't measure. We could measure Q or U, but we could never measure Q and U unless we do deck rotation.
It would be cool if you did a signal to noise estimate on the jackknife, so that you could say, "Oh yeah, that jackknife only has 3 It's a confusing picture because it spread the signal out all over the place. And
so we're not removing all that type of signal. We're removing that specific spatial temporal.
I know, it's just it's hard.
No, but we have hundreds of detector pairs, and for every detector pair, there's a different mode that we can remove. There are modes. So for every detector pair, it's two modes across the...
Yeah, but some of them overlap. Some of them overlap.
A big fraction of the noise instead of just the left picture. And you just need to remove a small amount.
It's a small loss of information, just like the polyfiltering and the ground subtraction is a small loss of information. All right, I'll make better pictures next time, but I better continue. Right? All right, so... None of this would be believable or worthwhile if we did not have extensive time stream level signal and noise simulations. So the signal sims sample from a curved sky map that comes out of SINFAST, right? The standard curved sky map. And so all EB mixing effects are naturally included in the simulations. The flat map that we use, so we can do this 2D FFT, the sky cut, the filtering, the deprojection, all of these things are included. So if we want to know, are we getting enough purity in our estimator, we can just ask the simulations, right? So you can do these simulations and you can predict how much false B mode you're getting, how much leakage you're getting from E into B or T into B. And you can just de-bias it out. But you can do better than that, right? At the moment, we're using a Kendrick-Smith-style pure B estimator, which eliminates sky cut-induced E to B mixing or renders it very small. But we're working on improved estimators. John's student, Kirit, is working on using the simulations themselves to deproject out the corrupted modes, because they know, right? They know which B modes appeared when you ran a sim with no input B modes. And the eventual goal is a full matrix-based analysis. But basically, we're improving the analysis as necessary rather than...
You say it's, you go back, you say that it's useful.
It only knows about sky cut induced DB mixing, it knows nothing about filtering, so it's incomplete.
But if you don't use that, is it absolutely essential, because otherwise
otherwise, the E to B mixing will dominate over the noise for the current level of sensitivity. Yeah, so we have to do at least something that's one step beyond the complete dumbass basic. All right, so we compare our jackknives to these signal plus noise sims. Basically, they pass. If you say that and it's a fact, then you're done, right? Well, maybe not, right? Because maybe there's a residual beam mismatch effect that corrupts the non-jackknife spectra but somehow evades the jackknives. And I've shown you an example where this AB offset effect very much corrupts the jackknife spectra, actually looks much better in the non-jackknife spectra. So that's not a beam mismatch in that category, right? That's quite the opposite. But maybe there could be, right? We know that, for instance, differential ellipticity will evade jackknives if it was uniform across the focal plane. So we've run many, many special simulations of different hypothetical beam mismatch effects, crosstalk effects, all sorts of crazy ideas. We can't find anything that's remotely plausible which could cause a false B at a level significant compared to the noise. In fact, we can't find anything at all that would evade jackknives and do that, right? All of these effects are way, way small. However, we've now, in the beam map analysis, we've now achieved sufficient signal to noise that we can just input the measured per channel beams directly into the simulations. And if we run then a no-pole simulation, we can see if the leakage is comparable to the kind of sensitivity levels we're trying to get to. And that's work in progress, so I can't say. But I doubt it will. And the signal to noise in those beam maps is now very, very good. Okay, so just a teaser of where we're at. So this is a signal plus noise simulation for the B modes for an input lambda CDM model. So an input model that has no B mode. Okay, so this is the B mode that you see from noise, from instrument noise, from E to B, residual E to B mixing. The simulation pipeline knows about everything, right? So this is the kind of thing you'd get if there was no B mode. And then if I add R of 0.1 to this realization, you can see a substantial change in the level. Right? So remember that the band powers that we quote are just the averages around these annuli. So you can get a visual impression of how many, you know, how significantly we can detect R0.1 from this plot. And that is as quantitative as it's going to get, I'm afraid.
So how much signal goes into this versus noise with R0.1?
So you have full-blown lambda CDM, right? And you have the full, everything that's done to the data, all of the filtering, the mapping, the deprojection. And these are the two-dimensional B-modes that result. And then we add just a little perturbation on top of lambda CDM corresponding to R0.1 in the B-modes.
Right. What do you assume
the noise? How much time? This is the three-year bicep 2 sim.
Yeah, you guys have probably done that, and you probably said that this is quite...
No, I take that back. I think this is two-year. I'll check. This must be two-year, because when we did this sim set, we weren't at the three-year yet. Sorry.
I mean, you maybe you've already given the answer, because you said this is as creative as going to get. You already know that ours is less than 0.12 at 95%. So do you have 0.05?
This is an amount of B modes corresponding to our 0.1. And if I wanted to make it 0.05, I would, you know, you can visually guess. I mean, no. I have these two plots to offer you. And I have these two. So this is the real E-mode map filtered to the angular scales at L of 100. And this is the real B-mode map. And this is still two-year. You see here, real two-year. Well, these were sims, right? This is just sims. This is real data. This is the real map. Sorry?
With the camera.
This is the B-mode map, but how much of it is noise? You don't know that, right? It doesn't tell you. Only the sims can tell you how much of this is noise, right? If I show you a signal plus noise sim, then maybe you could do something with your digital camera. So the E and the B-mode maps are something we make just for fun, just for kicks, right? The mainline analysis doesn't care about them at all. We do the Fourier transform, and then we go to 1D spectra. But you can go reverse if you want to, once you've done the E to B conversion, the QU to EB conversion. And that's why these are apodized, right? Because the apodization is in there now. And it's also filtered to, I think, an L range of like 40 to 120 or something like this to emphasize the gravitational B-mode angular scale region.
There's going to be structure in visual structure.
Oh, you're worried about the fact that it's... So I said these maps are just for kicks, right? They're not...
Some show the k-space filter, right?
I'm just trying to understand what is going in the real B-mode map that causes the structure that you see.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at sims, you'll see exactly the same kind of structures, right? I mean, it's something to do with the way that we've messed with the sky pattern. And it's nothing
so
mysterious.
The bandpass mismatch and all the projected...
This includes deprojection. The sims don't have any bandpass mismatch in them, but the deprojection that would take care of it is included. Right? So the filtering, all the filtering is there. All right. So conclusion, Keck array's running, it's got an instrument NET of 9.5 micro K root seconds. Bicep 2 analysis is pretty advanced, the data selection's all in place, the three-year QU maps have 0.12 microkelvin degree noise in about 400 square degrees. Careful simulations have been constructed with the differential pointing deprojection. I showed you how the jackknives start to pass. You only really need to turn this one on to make the jackknives pass. We're also turning on rel gain because it seems to have some minor beneficial effect. We have evidence that there are these bandpass mismatches. We are now fretting extensively about possible jackknife evading deprojection residuals, right? So things that we haven't deprojected that could produce a false B mode that would also evade jackknives. So this is a kind of very funny corners of parameter space where you would find such things, but maybe they're there.
Two questions, one really quick. All the kelvins up there, are they intensity kelvins or polarization kelvins?
They're all intensities. These are all NETs. Oh, No, this is the noise in the Q and the U maps. Yeah, these are Q and U map noises. This one is an NEC, as it says. Yeah, I guess.
So the second thing I was going to ask you is, I heard a spider talk where they said that one real advantage of spider is that in the very lowest L bins, say 30, L30, that the transfer function is significantly better. But in your talk, you're saying you're not losing much. So how do I parse this?
It seems like the NAB talk with the same claim.
No, in the published.
So if you go around this annulus, right, you've lost some fraction of the modes have been downweighted, right? So the filtering suppresses signal and noise equally, so it digs this trench out, right? But then when we do the correction, we do that in the Sims 2, and then we multiply those modes back up again when we do the correction, but we do the correction in 1D. Whereas the suppression has happened in 2D, right? So you've downweighted some of your mods. And the information loss, if you then just do in the sim, if you just don't do that, it's, you know, 10 to 20% in the error bars.
I think the point is that you should not confuse the filter function, which says how much is the signal and noise suppressed in that bit. With the loss of NRC, which is information in that bit. People often do confuse that.
Yes. I mean, they're related, but they're not the same number. And the information loss is smaller, right?
What's the offset relative to the correction?
John gave it's like 2 arc minutes.
So it's a bad pixel, but a typical one device.
Yeah, and the beam's like 30 arc minutes across. So, but in some of the CAC focal planes, it's way better. Right? So bicep 2 is kind of the worst case.
If you map out all the band counts,
so attempts have been made to measure per channel bandpasses using an FTS mounted on the front. I don't know that those are really the best. They're hard measurements to make, right? And so we have interesting. So one thing I didn't show, and when I went to look for plots to show this, I didn't find as many of them on our group logbook as there should be. There have been lots of attempts to correlate these deprojection coefficients with external calibration data, right? So with the beam map coefficients, with FTS data, for instance, to say, you know, do the ones that appear to have a bad passband mismatch in the CMB data, are they the same ones that you can identify with an FTS? And the answer is, in most cases, yeah, you find correlations exactly as you expect, right? Everything makes sense. Does it make sense exactly to the level of precision of the different measurements? Well, that gets... that's still work in progress, but you know, these deprojection coefficients, they're very stable with time, some of them. They correlate with external measurements. Everything makes sense, right? The process works. Okay. Sorry about that.